money woes mount for the RNC in Jacksonville. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, we'll look at a new report in the New York Times showing how the RNC is creating money woes in two cities, both Charlotte and Jacksonville. Can the city host this event and pay for it? Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Then later, more local health professionals expressing their concerns over coronavirus, along with dozens of local churches. We'll tell you about that, too. Speaking of the coronavirus, we need to let you know there are three new federally funded COVID-19 testing sites going up this week. They open up Wednesday morning, one at First Coast High School, one at Frank H. Peterson Academies, and one at the Regency Square Mall. These will be drive-through testing sites. More about this at the City of Jack's website. We'll have it up on our website today as well. The coronavirus crisis is out of control now in Florida. We are above 200,000 cases of the virus. That's an increase of 10,000 over the last day and an increase of 29 deaths. The death toll in the state is at 3731. Despite these spiking numbers, part of the Republican National Convention is still scheduled to take place here in Jacksonville at the end of August. But assuaging concerns about the virus is not the only challenge organizers are facing. According to a new report in the New York Times, fundraising woes are also plaguing the event. Annie Carney is a White House correspondent for the New York Times and one of the journalists looking into this story, and she's on the line. Annie, it's good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
And here's our question to callers as we speak with Annie Carney of the New York Times. What are your questions about the difficulties the Jacksonville Host Committee is having raising money to pay for the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville? Remember, we've been told the city won't be on the hook for this event, that it will be paid for privately. Donors and host committee members are having a hard time with this because of concerns about coronavirus. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is already having a lively discussion about this. We'll get to those comments in a moment. Well, Annie, as you reported over the weekend in the Times, tens of millions of dollars has already been spent to host the Republican National Convention in Charlotte. And now that the event has been moved here to Jacksonville, donors are leery about opening their wallets again to bankroll the event here in Northeast Florida. What are they telling you?
Yeah, there's, well, the decision to move it out of Charlotte, which was Trump's decision after reaching an impasse with the Democratic governor there, about social distancing and mask wearing policies, has created a complete mess. So the Charlotte Host Committee had raised $38 million already out of the $70 million the whole thing was going to cost. All of that money has already been spent. They have nothing to return to donors yet, nothing to pass on to Jacksonville. That means the Jacksonville Host Committee is left starting from zero in June for a show that's supposed to go on in August that usually takes 2 years of planning. It's going to be a far scaled down version. They're trying to raise a fraction of the $70 million that Charlotte was going to cost. But A, Charlotte donors are a little bit peeved that they gave money for something that's literally not happening anymore and the money's just gone. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of touchy feelings about asking those donors to give again. And then other donors are saying they're not even sure, like it's not 100% clear to them that this thing is actually going to be pulled off. You mentioned that COVID is out of control in Florida right now. Donors are hesitant to give a lot of money to this thing when it's really very precarious what even is going to be possible in August for a convention at all.
You quoted Ed Burr, a local real estate developer, member of the Jacksonville Host Committee, prominent local Republican businessman, as saying this has been a challenge and that even though a lot of people think it's a bad idea, they're still going forward. Did the host committee members express to you, look, we're still committed to this no matter what, or do they seem to be having second thoughts?
They're forging ahead. But even Ed Burr, who's probably, he's someone who's thrilled to have the convention come to Jacksonville. He's someone who told us, in a quote-unquote normal time, Jacksonville is not a city that would ever be considered for something like this. This would go to a much bigger city. So this is huge economic impact for Jacksonville. So he's thrilled, but he's saying, you know, a lot of people think this is a terrible idea. He's admitting that on the record. Other people told us, other people involved with the host committee said there must be a plan B, because even though no one's talking about it publicly, there's just so much insecurity around this whole thing for money reasons, for hotel room reasons, for COVID reasons, that it's just like the most difficult fundraising situation they've ever confronted, and there has to be a backup plan.
We're speaking with reporter Annie Carney of the New York Times. We'll go to your calls in a moment at 549-2937 as she finds money woes are plaguing the Jacksonville Host Committee as they try to figure out how to pay for the Republican National Convention here in Jacksonville in August. Big donors are reluctant to write checks for this event due to the surging coronavirus in Florida. And you know, Annie, a recent UNF poll found that nearly 70% of people in this community do not want the event here. They're concerned about the virus. We just received, by the way, this morning, a letter from 36 local African-American churches, clergy officials sending an open letter out, and I'm going to quote here, "As clergy and community leaders, we urge our city officials to reconsider hosting the Republican National Convention." And it goes on to say that they just believe that it will be too dangerous to public health and also ethnic tensions in the city in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. And so there's overwhelming opposition to this event being here for the reasons that we've just laid out. And as you're seeing, that is complicating the fundraising efforts, because the mayor and the host committee have said repeatedly that we, the taxpayers, will not have to foot the bill for this. There's concern that the city might be left holding the bag for paying some of the bill.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's so much opposition to having it in Jacksonville, and yet part of the reason it was selected was the mayor, you know, advocate. He tweeted, like, "We'd love to have you." The mayor is amenable to this. And the reason it appealed to the RNC is because a lot of the mayor controls a lot of things that he wouldn't control in other cities, permitting process. The actual venue, the arena, is owned by the city, so it makes it a lot cheaper than the arena that was in Charlotte. So there's a lot of things about Jacksonville that make it easier for them to hold this thing if they have a supportive mayor who's working along with them, which they do. But this the city is full of other tensions. I imagine we haven't seen a Trump event go off since the murder of George Floyd without protests associated with it in Jacksonville. I understand from reading it, there's been tension with the police department over of killing of black men there too.
Right.
I imagine that storyline will be still going and resuscitated by August.
Yeah, and the event is scheduled to take place on the 60th anniversary here of Axe Handle Saturday, which happened during the height of the civil rights movement in Jacksonville, when a white mob beat civil rights demonstrators with baseball bats and axe handles as they were trying to integrate downtown lunch counters in 1960. Not only that, you know, let's talk about the fact that in this city we now have a mask order in place to try to tamp down transmission of COVID. Many have asked the question, you know, if that mandate is still in place in late August when the RNC comes to ViStar Veterans Memorial Arena, will it be followed by the Trump campaign? Because under the rules right now, you cannot be under a roof without a mask.
Right. They have said, the White House press secretary said their advice on mask wearing is to tell people to follow the directives of their local officials. That being said, they've been very wishy-washy about their own mask directives. They just announced that Trump will hold a rally in New Hampshire this weekend, and they said mask wearing is strongly encouraged, which is still, you know, for where we are in terms of COVID, strongly encouraged is a baby step from, you know, seeming to encourage not to wear it towards actually requiring it. We'll see where we are. I mean, if the local ordinance is to wear a mask, they have indicated that they will tell people to follow, they will follow that lead of the local officials.
We're speaking with reporters.
And to be, one more thing, the thing that I was told that bothered the president about Charlotte was not so much an audience full of people wearing masks, but was the social distancing. So I think they would want to have people wear masks, but I think the place where they will dig in more is on social distancing.
They want a crowd, in other words,
yes,
for the cameras.
Correct.
We speak with reporter Annie Carney of the New York Times, she has found that fundraisers in Jacksonville find money is on hold because of concerns about the surge in virus cases here in Florida. What are your questions about this as we look ahead to the RNC in Jacksonville in late August? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Michael is at the beaches. Hi, Michael.
Hi, I'm a business owner out at the beach, and because of this, I'm a hairstylist, and I'm going to close down my shop, and then for 2 weeks after, if anybody's gone to this event, I'm going to quarantine them from coming in, because a lot of people are bringing this virus in out of the beach, to hair salons right now. So anyway, my concern is I was told that they're going to bring a cruise ship in to house all the police. Who's going to pay for that?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that, Michael, but
somebody on the inside.
Yeah, thanks for that. So Michael, you're saying you're just going to shut your business down during the window of time the convention is here?
The people I know, they're leaving town because it's just, we're paying attention to the numbers. And as far as educated people, they're like, we don't want to be around this, and they're going to bring people out to the beach and to the restaurants. So then for 2 weeks after, the businesses are going to have to worry to our employees.
Yeah.
Again.
Thanks, Michael. And I appreciate all your points. Thanks for that. Annie Carney, that goes in line with the polling we're seeing, that there's such concern about this event. I'm not sure what that noise was, but that there's such concern about this event being a super spreader event for this community to the point where business owners might shut down. People are talking about leaving town during this window. What about that?
I mean, that's a valid concern. We've seen a lot of cases come out of Tulsa of the prominent people that, potentially the prominent people that the president brought with him. We saw Herman Cain, who was at the Tulsa rally, announced he had been hospitalized for COVID. Kimberly Guilfoyle, the president's son's girlfriend, found out on Friday she has tested positive for COVID. She was at the Tulsa rally. Their serious concern was, and now the Trump campaign is kind of trying to keep going, but they've conceded that indoor rallies maybe not a good idea right now. Bringing together large groups of people inside are, potentially creating super spreader events. That's what all health officials are telling us. So I think it's a valid concern, and I think that the businesses fleeing does kind of defeat the whole purpose of bringing a convention to town, which is for the city, usually about economic impact. That will depress it. And I said that the people I talked to on the business side involved said that conventions usually bring about $200 million of economic impact to a city that's holding it. And they're estimating that this will be half of that, which they're still saying will be great for Jacksonville. But I think the reason the estimate is so much lower than usual is partly because people will close businesses and go away.
Kevin tweets the show, point out that Milwaukee will see a fraction of the $200 million economic impact that was expected because they're having a reduced scale convention for the Democrats. And here's a tweet for you. Based on her calls with Ed Burr and others, what does she think it will take to persuade the host committee organizers to change the format of the RNC to a pandemic-tailored, safer approach?
I think that will be up to the president saying he is okay with that. I think that this is coming from the top. The reason it got moved from Charlotte in the first place is because the president himself was unhappy with what he thought Roy Cooper, the governor, could provide him with. So I think that it will take Donald Trump saying, I'm fine with having a virtual convention, no convention, to have them
There have been other published reports, one in particular in Vanity Fair from unnamed sources close to the president, saying that they're probably going to pull the plug on the Republican convention in Jacksonville because of all of these concerns. You're not hearing that, though, are you?
No, I'm not hearing that. I'm hearing that they're making great efforts to have testing, to make people feel safe, have a lot of testing around this actual site, to make it as safe as possible, to be able to have it and feel like they're not creating a dangerous super spreader event. That's what I've heard.
It's 549-2937 to connect with Annie Carney of the New York Times. What are your thoughts about new revelations that the RNC host committee here in Jacksonville is having a hard time raising money to pay for the Republican National Convention festivities here in August? 549-2937. Ray is in St. Augustine. Hi, Ray.
Who's going to pay for the convention security if the city of Jacksonville doesn't do it? Thank you.
Security. Yeah, Annie, that's whether it's security costs or other costs, people overwhelmingly, and there are comments like this on our Facebook page too. Here's one from Jim saying, if they can't raise enough money to cover the events, will the city of Jacksonville taxpayers be on the hook for the shortfall? Overwhelmingly, that's the most common question we're being asked about this. We don't really have specific answers yet.
No, I don't think we have answers yet. I mean, I think that Republican officials would say no, that they won't be, that the party and donors will cover it all. But we don't know. I don't have a good answer for that right now.
Yeah, we'll have to continue looking into that. But as you pointed out, the whole reason this is happening is because the governor in North Carolina would not promise the Trump campaign the kicking away of safety measures like social distancing and mask wearing. Initially, they thought they'd be coming to Jacksonville with a completely unfettered event. Now, though, that's changed because we do have a mask order in place for the city of Jacksonville in all indoor public settings.
I think it's what's happening is reality is setting in that in Charlotte with a governor they viewed as a political opponent, they thought that the governor was trying to make life harder for Trump because of politics. And they didn't trust that he wasn't going to play games with them and make their convention look terrible in the end. Now what's becoming clear is that it's not about politics. It's actually almost impossible to stage a large-scale group gathering while we're having a resurgence of this pandemic. And they're confronting some of the same pains that they would have had in Charlotte, on top of which starting from scratch planning a convention on the fly. So just the reality that they can't kind of run away and find a nice place to just have it the way they want to have it is setting in.
Yeah, here's an email from a listener. Former Republicans like myself, who are sickened by this event being held on Axe Handle Saturday, will be wearing masks and staying 6 feet apart and staying home. Trump supporters at the rallies and the convention will not. Holding this convention is insane during this COVID pandemic, she says. Listener from Mandarin. And so, as you just pointed out, Annie, there really is no hospitable place at this point to hold an event like this in America, not even here where you have a unified local Republican leadership in the city of Jacksonville. That was initially seen as a selling point.
Yeah, I mean, digging your heels in at this stage to say we have to have something, a renominating show, is problematic. And we're seeing it not just with the convention, but with the Trump campaign trying to forge forward with rallies. When, you know, we saw the debacle of Tulsa, where the reality of it was, no matter what they said and no matter how much they hyped this thing, people were more scared of this virus than they had accounted for, and the stadium was mostly empty. This reality that even Trump supporters are scared of this thing, that Donald Trump can't talk his way out of this, can't create his own reality around this pandemic the way he has been able to do on other issues, is becoming more and more clear. And I think kind of the reason, at least with the rallies leading up to the convention, that they're so intent on doing them is because right now he's losing in all of the polls to Joe Biden, and it's seen as you know, they want to restart this because they think it could help him politically.
Perry writes on our Facebook page, hopefully one side benefit of this year is that political conventions will no longer be called conventions, but rallies, because that's what they are. They are anachronisms from bygone days when the nominee would be chosen at them. The primary system all but obviates the need for that. He's right in that conventions are basically just parties at this point for each political party, get-togethers, big shows on television. Assuming the RNC goes forward as planned here in Jacksonville the way the president wants it, how will they appear differently on TV, do you think, Annie? The Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee for Joe Biden, which will be massively scaled down, versus the Republican National Convention here in Jacksonville?
Well, that's another thing. That's another reason the donors are held up, is because a lot of the reason people give money to these things is for all of the parties that bring together lobbyists, business leaders and elected officials to, you know, be in a room together. No one's going to be doing that kind of thing this year. So it makes giving $1 million if you're a business to this thing, like, you're not getting much for your money. How will it look different on television? I think that is where, you know, the president is keenly aware of how things play on TV. For him, I think he's not so concerned about the party business that takes place at these conventions. I think in his mind, a lot of people around him have said, like, the convention is the night he takes the stage and gives a very important speech in a like big stage with his family around him, with a cheering crowd. To him, that's the convention. It is when he's the star of a bigger show than the usual shows of which he is the star. So I think that the focus will be on, and he will be involved with, making sure that night where he gives his speech, his renominating speech, looks powerful. That's what he cares most about.
Mary in Ortega emails the show, "I'm a former Republican who recently switched to Democrat, and I bought a face shield for RNC week. I'm hoping that will scare people into staying at least 6 feet away from me. It's sad I have to resort to trying to scare people to get them to comply with social distancing, especially during RNC week," which is the last week in August, by the way. Let's go to Tim on the South Side. Hi, Tim. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm just calling to try to understand, what's the difference between, you know, the liberal camp promoting and suggesting that people go out and protest, and why isn't there concern of, you know, the virus and 6 feet apart there, but there's this big narrative on the concern of the Democrat or the Republican National Convention? What's
yeah.
the big difference?
Thanks, Tim. You know, Annie, we get that question a lot, and
yeah,
people have asked, you know, why isn't there concern about all of the protests that have taken place all over America, including here in Jacksonville? Didn't that spread the virus? There is concern about it, but most of those protesters were wearing masks, and they've studied this. You are at far lower risk of getting the virus if you're outside than if you're in an indoor enclosed space for several hours with people who aren't masked. And so,
that's right.
If you could answer his comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've heard a lot of this, especially from Trump campaign officials, saying it's such a double standard of the media, who appear to be cheering on the protesters, but expressing horror at the Trump rallies. And I don't think that's accurate, that anyone is cheering anyone on, but there have been already the George Floyd protests. Now we're far enough out of that to look at the effect. And because they were outside and because people were at mass, it doesn't look like the numbers of COVID cases shot up a lot. So it was actually, if you want to look at it as a public health test, it was good news for outdoor transmission. There was not a lot, it didn't result in big spikes of the virus. I think the difference is indoor and not wearing masks. If standing 6 feet apart. I think if it's outdoors, if people are masked and apart, it the it seems to be safer.
Yeah. Although, to be fair, to answer that caller's question, certainly some of these protest people were not socially distanced. That said, they were mainly masked, 90% plus masked, and they were outdoors. And because of those two factors, the studies you just referenced, Annie, found that they didn't contribute to an uptick in COVID cases. What people that study this are finding more and more is that it's being spread person to person in indoor settings. When you're around someone, talking closely with them, right next to them, for an extended period of time, or around a lot of people under a roof for an extended period of time without a mask. And so that's where the concern comes. There is more about this in the New York Times. She's reporter Annie Carney. And Annie, thank you so much for sharing this with all of us down here in Florida.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
And much more still ahead. Later, WJCT's all news talk format kicks off next week as we speak with station manager David Luckin on that. But up next.
With the COVID-19, we have seen a huge influx of people. Some days we see over 100% increase in need in food.
The food insecure need your help right now in this pandemic. We'll tell you about one group feeding those that need it. Back in a moment.
For years, StoryCorps has brought you voices of loved ones having meaningful conversations. Now, in collaboration with WJCT, we're bringing people together for a different kind of dialogue. It's called One Small Step. We're pairing strangers who don't see eye to eye for a conversation, learning the stories behind each other's values. Sign up at WJCT.org/OSS.
StoryCorps' One Small Step is made possible in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Electro Lounge can now be heard 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on WJCT 89.9 HD4 Electro Lounge Radio or on the WJCT app. Electro Lounge Radio, part of the Jacksonville Music Experience.
Welcome back. The COVID pandemic and the spike in unemployment means many more people are food insecure in this community. One organization is stepping up to meet that need right now. Bill Brim is Executive Director of Lutheran Social Services of Northeast Florida. Bill Brim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate you having me on today.
In this time of pandemic and recession, organizations like Lutheran Social Services are more important than ever. You've been responding to the need in the community. Let's begin with food insecurity. What are you seeing and what are you doing about it?
With the COVID-19, we have seen a huge influx of people because of unemployment, furloughed people, and we've seen an 82% increase overall. Some days we see over 100% increase in need in food and services. So what we've done is we've actually partnered to expand our partnership with Feeding Northeast Florida to have two mobile food drives, the first Wednesday and the third Friday of each month. And so we just had that yesterday, and it was a huge success. We fed over 2,000 families. So
wow.
That
shows you the need, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah, people are out of work. People need food, and they're turning to groups like yours. Now, you've also reopened another program you're known for, refugee resettlement. Refugees had slowed to a trickle during the Trump administration and their change in immigration policies. So what's changed that? Why did you decide to reopen this program and start resettling refugees again here in our area?
So it's been a cornerstone program of our other programs inside our agency. We have the Consolidated Refugee Services Grant, meaning we do all the services for Northeast Florida as far as refugee DCF operated programs. So this is a huge key to people coming in and getting those services. So with World Relief being closed and only us and Catholic Charities being open at this, you know, now back open, it's very vital that we have this. We changed our program in where we are doing shared responsibility. So we're cross-training our folks where we're used to when we brought in a group of people, we would have staff, and they would work with that population. And when the refugees stopped coming in, what we would do is actually we had to let go of those staff because we didn't have the funding. So what I've done is cross-train where I can put them back into programs and still be able to keep the knowledge base there at the agency.
Hmm. Families coming in from all over the world still to this area and needing help?
They are. They're, more than ever right now with just the ban on travel, we have, around 10,000 refugees that can continue with refugee resettlement. As soon as, they open up the travel to the United States. So, again, we're ready to serve those. We're just waiting for, again, these bans on travel to open up.
So basically, there's a list of people wanting to travel here that you're waiting to help. They just can't come yet, correct?
Correct, yes.
And
they're in other countries that might have traveled there and just be stuck in the midst of travel.
For people that are already on the ground here, tell us a little bit more about the need you're seeing in this community, because we are dealing with high unemployment, worries about coronavirus, people trying to balance taking care of children and working. That's going to become more of a problem when back to school happens, too. What are the biggest issues you're seeing out there?
Of course, the big need in the community right now, what we are seeing is just, help with utilities, rent, rental assistance, and food is the largest one. I mean, if you can imagine. And a lot of people, too, you got to think about if you pay, if you've given to a nonprofit or if you've given to a United Way campaign, you've paid something forward. So it's time for, them to come and not be ashamed, because it's just like pulling up to Publix and getting your trunk loaded with groceries. So,
Exactly. So how can people be part of these food pickups, as you say, that you're doing regularly now?
Sure. We're one of the only agencies that we're open 5 days a week. We're located at 4615 Phillips Highway, and that's 32207. And we're open Monday through Friday. So through the corona pandemic, we have not closed at all. We've just changed our service model from a market model where they got to choose the items to we go out the front of the door and with grocery carts, and we serve our clients right at the car. They don't get out. All we do is we ask their name and how many are in their family, and their trunk or back seat is loaded up with food with them not getting out, and so it's a no-touch food pantry.
It's open
10 to 12 Monday through Friday. So, again, 5 days a week that anybody can get food. And then we have a mobile pantry, again, the first Wednesday and the third Friday that's, sponsored with Feeding Northeast Florida, that they can visit our pantry twice a month now. So, because the need is just so big.
Go to lssjax.org for more. And he's Bill Brim, Executive Director of Lutheran Social Services, Northeast Florida. Bill, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, healthcare professionals in our area continue to speak out about the COVID crisis and their concerns about how the pandemic is being handled here in Florida. Ask Nurses and Doctors is a new group of healthcare professionals here on the First Coast, joining together to voice their concerns. And right now we welcome two members to the show. Dr. Donald George, he's Emeritus Chief of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition at Nemours Children's Subspecialty Care. Dr. George, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having us.
Good to have you. Also on the line, Dana Farrell Birchfield. She's Executive Director of the Florida Association of Children's Hospitals. Dana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for allowing us to be part of...
Okay, Dana, we can't quite hear you. We'll try to fix that connection, but in the meantime, let's go to Dr. George. Doctor, tell us about Ask Nurses and Doctors and your primary mission.
Sure. We're a group, basically, of healthcare professionals who are brought together by both our commitment to science and our concern for our patients. And we were, of course, galvanized over the issue of the COVID epidemic and the effect that it's had in our community. We wish to speak for the safety of the community, the importance of public health, and the importance of health care for our patients.
Dr. George, we do have a citywide mask order in Jacksonville now. We have ramped up testing sites around the community. What else do you think the city should be doing to, and the state, to better manage this crisis?
Well, first, I'd like to congratulate Mayor Curry for doing the mask mandate. It must have been very difficult. I know there was a lot of pressure against it. But very clearly, we know that what works is avoiding closed spaces, avoiding crowded places, avoiding close contact, wearing masks, washing your hands. What we need to continue to do is both expand testing, but also put into place through our public health department the ability to do contact tracing. And then we will both get the information we need to control, but also it'll give us the tool we need to get to the patients more quickly, prevent spread.
We do have Dana Farrell-Birchfield back on the line. She's Executive Director of the Florida Association of Children's Hospitals. Hi, Dana.
Hi there. Welcome.
Thank you.
All of us.
Yeah, thank you for being with us. So your group, Ask Nurses and Doctors, is advocating, as Dr. George said, for increased contact tracing in Florida. How much work do you think the state needs to do to better execute contact tracing on this virus?
This is a question, actually, that has gone on even before COVID has inflicted us. Florida, as have many states, have underfunded their public health resources. We didn't have an army of contract tracers prepared, or even a subset that could be shifted from other public health duties. So we were really behind the curve before COVID. Now, despite some of the generous packages that Congress has passed in the CARES Act, we still don't have enough resources to put enough contract tracers on the ground. So unfortunately, it is going to take more resources and the lag time of training the contact tracers, because that it is a unique set of skills.
Right, and it's a difficult job, as we've been learning, Dr. George. It's an inexact science at best, but contact tracing can help public health experts better get a handle on the virus and bring the curve down. Now, in addition to that, does your group Ask Nurses and Doctors plan to take a public position on the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville?
Well, indeed we have, and again, our position is that having that many people coming in, and they're going to be coming in from hot spots in Texas and Louisiana and California and Arizona, it is going to serve as a super spreader event. And again, as we had said before, and your previous guest had alluded, it's going to be a closed space. It's going to be crowded. There's going to be close contact. And all of the things that our Department of Health has recommended against, we're not going to be able to enforce in this particular venue, in this particular situation. And again, I applaud our governor. On his Facebook page, he had put the Department of Health recommendations about contact and washing the hands and wearing of the mask. Whether changes can be made so that the convention can be done safely is certainly above my pay grade.
So you're not calling for it to be canceled, you're calling for it to be made safer.
I think that we're going to need to have discussion as a community about whether this can be done safely. You know, is there an option to do a completely outdoor event? Is there an option to make sure that everybody is wearing a mask? Is there an option to have that many people come in and also socially distance? Again, we're learning very rapidly what works to help contain the virus, what mitigates the infection. Whether those learnings can be applied to something the scale of the Republican Convention is just very hard to say. It's not looking good, though.
Dana, the Jacksonville City Council may look at some of these types of measures. Do you think that they should weigh in?
In my personal opinion, absolutely. This is our city. There are representatives. I think they need to be aware of the risks that we may be incurring, the risk-reward benefit with some economic stimulus. May be a high price to pay, which takes us back to contract tracing and good practices, because if we do have even a modified type RNC in Jacksonville, we're going to have to do some significant contract tracing, which we, as I said earlier and you alluded to, we have not done in Florida. And we went from South Miami, Dade, Palm Beach, Broward to Orange Park. And if we had been tracing, if we'd had contract tracing, we might have been able to get ahead of the curve on the spread throughout the state. So when you bring in, as Dr. George just said, when you bring in all of these folk who are coming from different parts of the country, some of which will obviously be hotspots themselves. All of our hotel and restaurant workers, our service workers, our police, they're going to be exposed. So it's a challenge, and I certainly hope the city council does their homework and weighs in, as some of our other groups in the city have.
Dr. George, just a minute or so before we go to break, will your group ask nurses and doctors take your concerns directly to Jacksonville City Hall?
Yes, and indeed a group of doctors, over 300, have signed a letter to Mayor Curry expressing exactly those concerns and recommendations for what we think needs to go on in order to do this project safely.
Here's an email from a listener. I believe Duval County has not yet even hired any contact tracers. I'm trying to get a job like this. I was offered one in Gainesville, but not in Duval. We'll follow up on that. Thanks for that email. And I want to thank you both for joining us, Dr. Donald George with Nemours and Dana Farrell Birchfield, Florida Association of Children's Hospitals. They are both with the new group Ask Nurses and Doctors, speaking out about concerns regarding pandemic handling in Florida. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you. Bye now.
And in a moment, you can still find the music here at WJCT, plus lots of news and talk. We'll tell you about it after this.
A handful of copper matte plates made by the British in 1780 and lost until the 1940s finally make their way back to the FHS collections. Coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Dr. James Cusick about these exciting artifacts. We'll discuss the Rockledge Resort District, and we'll learn about early pottery in Florida. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
McDonald's Restaurants has a legacy of building Black wealth through its franchise business model. But that didn't come without some costs.
Whether it's the low wages or the health disparities or the access to fresh food in communities of color, it really has been an incredibly mixed and challenging legacy.
A conversation with historian Marcia Chatelain about her book, Franchise, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 here on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. The state of Wyoming is facing a huge budget shortfall as the state's oil and gas revenues crater in the pandemic. But life goes on.
Note that the Department of Health has approved a variance to allow the Cody Knight Rodeo. It was something I mentioned I was hopeful to see happen.
The governor of Wyoming next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Since 2017, 1A's been listening to the beating and increasingly troubled heart of America. It's a space that asks America what it wants to be and elevates people and perspectives from people across the country, from people like you. Hi, I'm Jen White, the show's new host. Join me as we tackle the issues that matter most next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. And that is the familiar sound of a little chill-out music from WJCT's own beloved late-night show, The Electro Lounge. We want to tell you about a big change. After 15 years on the air, Electro Lounge, the radio show, will become Electro Lounge Radio 24/7. This change is going to take place Monday, July 13th, 1 week from today, when 89.9 FM completes its transition to an all-news information format. Station manager and Electro Lounge host David Luckin here now with more. Hey, David.
Hey, Melissa. Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's good to have you.
I was just going to say I lost
thank
my...
you to WJCT. Yeah.
No, that too. Yes. First of all, let's thank WJCT for allowing me to play all this crazy and good music for 15 years. But what I was going to say was we actually launched Electro Lounge Radio in April, so we've given it a little runway to get out there for people. So as we end Electro Lounge, the program on our main channel, it's there 24/7 on HD4 and, of course, on the WJCT app. You know, Melissa, I see my smartphone now as my own transistor radio.
Yeah.
I can get our classical station, our 60s, 70s, and 80s station, or Electro Lounge radio all on the app. Or if you have an HD radio in your car or at home on HD4, Electro Lounge always there for you.
That's right. You can listen in lots of different ways, and you have at your fingertips now so much more music. And this is the kind of music programming you will hear nowhere else, anywhere, on the radio or on other streaming services.
That's very true.
This is unique.
It is. And I'm still programming the Electro Lounge, so if you're worried that we're not going to play all this great music, we're still going to play it. I'm also programming Anthology, the music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Which leads me to thank all the listeners who have been there for the last 15 years, all your support and the sponsors. We thank you so much. And don't go anywhere because we're expanding the show. The show's not going away. It's going 24/7. I just won't talk as much.
But there is one final week of shows this week, and you're going to be doing some special stuff.
We're going to play all of our favorite music for the last 15 years. So as usual, you'll hear it from Robert Johnson and B.B. King to the best chill out of Vargo and DeFaz and all the great music we played in between. Some mellow rap like Stay Human with Michael Franti and all the songs we played for 15 years. I kind of went through until 3 o'clock this morning and did this whole week's worth of shows. And it's going to be a nice little trip down memory lane, but it's also your invitation to stay with us on HD4 because we're not going anywhere. We're actually expanding the show from 2 hours to 24 hours. So you're going to have all the great music you always want, except you're going to have it anytime you want. You don't have to wait till 9 or 10 o'clock at night. You can just turn on HD4 or the app and chill out.
And there's your music. This is all part of the brainchild of you and some other
and David
great
McGowan.
Minds. Yes. David McGowan, our CEO here. This is a brand new music platform we've created at WJCT, the Jacksonville Music Experience, JME. If you go to our website, you can learn all about it. This is just multiple platforms, multiple stations, multiple ways to get independently programmed music that isn't the kind of boring playlist that you might hear somewhere else.
And you know why that is, Melissa, because most stations have 100 or 200 songs in rotation, and all the stations we have 2,000 or 3,000 songs. So we really like to mix it up, and you don't hear the same song every day at the same time. You hear a different song every day at that same hour, whether it's classical music on HD2 or anthology, the best music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, where Blues Horizon and Doo-Wop Revival can be found now on Sunday nights on anthology. And Electro Lounge Radio, we're going to keep music from the hearts of space Saturday at 11. We've got a jazz brunch Sunday, every Sunday from 10 to 12. And, of course, Jazz Night in America, 6 o'clock on Sunday nights on Electro Lounge Radio. So we're adding fresh songs every day, and we're not going anywhere.
That's right. So everyone understands, if you turn on terrestrial radio after this week, you will hear news and talk at night after 7 o'clock at night.
Right.
You won't hear music anymore on 89.9. But if you go to our HD stations or through our WJCT app, you will find lots of music, even more music than before.
Exactly. So we've actually given all of our music a nice home, a nice umbrella over it all to keep it safe, keep you chilled out and entertained and enlightened. We like to help you discover new music. And that doesn't mean new music. Sometimes it's old music that you just haven't heard before. So we will continue to do that. And we will keep Turntable Tuesday. We'll be on Anthology now. And I think, I'm going to whisper this, I think we'll do the Allman Brothers' first album next Tuesday
to kick it all off.
Gorgeous album. And with their local connection and our Void connection, that seemed like an appropriate place to start.
Okay, and I want to give you kudos for 15 years of hosting this groundbreaking show and building loyal fans, not just in Jacksonville, but all over the world who love the Electro Lounge. And kudos on an amazing run and a whole new chapter, David.
I appreciate it. We thank Tony Allegretti and all the folks in Springfield who got this show on the air way back when.
That's right. We're going to close with your favorite song, Stay Human.
From Michael Franti. Here you go. Enjoy.
Have a great Monday, everyone. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
Sound of boom, bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom, bop. Tell your neighbor, tell the friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. Because the streets are alive. Sound of boom, bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom, bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every box got a right to be blooming. Every flower got a right to be blooming. Every child got a right to be zooming. Stay here.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.